Welcome to the podcast of Sound Medicine, Public Radio's weekly health news magazine. I'm your host, Barbara Lewis. This free podcast is produced by WFYI Indianapolis in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters. I'm Barbara Lewis. Today on Sound Medicine, the controversy over a very expensive drug for hepatitis.
The cure rates were essentially 99%. Which is very, wow is correct. Wow.
So it's really bringing everyone to the table to find a solution so that access to these treatments can be sustained.
Plus, whether you can prevent preeclampsia with baby aspirin, and how doctors deal with patients who don't want to take their medicine.
I won't do sometimes just shorthand for I have very reasonable concerns about cost or about side effects or about other things.
Hospice care for pets.
People are surprised that this option can exist, and I think they're extremely grateful.
A doctor who traded her stethoscope for fitness coaching.
At what point do you already hit the 150-minute mark?
Woo, sometimes by Monday afternoon.
All that and more next on Sound Medicine.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine, and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Welcome to Sound Medicine, Public Radio's weekly news magazine about medicine and health. I'm Barbara Lewis. Our top story this week is the tug of war between a new class of drugs that's curing a chronic disorder, and the high price tag that's giving healthcare administrators heartburn. The drug is sofosbuvir, which is sold under the name of Sovaldi. It's used to treat hepatitis C, the blood-borne virus that was just discovered in 1986. It was often spread through risky sex and drug use, and after lying dormant for years, it is now showing up in a lot of aging baby boomers.
As we look through medicine, there are very few diseases that I think you can say with such precision that you really are cured.
That's Dr. Paul Kuo. He's a professor at the IU School of Medicine, and he's a specialist in treating hepatitis. What makes Sovaldi different is that it's part of a new class of drugs that is both more effective and much better tolerated than older drugs such as interferon. And that means more people are candidates to take it. Dr. Kuo told me it's having remarkable results.
Across the board, you're going to see efficacy rates above 95%. Above 95.
And that's a cure?
Cure.
Rate?
So you are cured. So the way I like to explain hepatitis C to patients, it's like a light switch. It's either on or it's off.
A 12-week treatment of Sovaldi costs $84,000. But it's not really the price tag per person that's making Sovaldi the topic of congressional hearings. Rather, it's the overall cost of treating hepatitis C that's going to be astronomical as more baby boomers are diagnosed and treated. Here's the point. Older therapies were expensive too, but not as many people took them, and fewer were actually cured. So without a doubt, the Hep C price tag is high. The difference is now the cure rate is too.
That has all changed now.
Let's back up to set the scene. Hepatitis is inflammation of the liver, in this case, caused by a virus.
Just like, for instance, if you have your hands in dishwater and they become red and irritated, that's a dermatitis. If you get pink eye, that's conjunctivitis, that's inflammation.
If the inflammation continues for years, there's scarring called fibrosis. Severe liver scarring is called cirrhosis. In the past, the treatment has been transplantation or, in less severe cases, a course of genetically engineered interferon.
If you get the flu, you have flu-like symptoms, you have a fever, those are your white cells releasing interferon. So for years, we've been giving this same medicine, although a synthetic protein of interferon, to stimulate the immune system to clear the virus from the liver in combination with another medicine.
Interferon treatments worked for about 70% of people with hepatitis C, but the side effects took a real toll.
Interferon had effects on the bone marrow, depression, caused such severe depression that you could commit suicide on interferon. All of that is gone. I am so impressed over the last 20 years that the people who have tolerated these interferon-based therapies, they have been cured, but they have gone to work feeling like they've had the flu for a year. And these are people who have earned my respect enormously that they've been able to be cured.
The scene changed in 2013 when drug maker Gideon introduced Sovaldi. It works by binding to the hepatitis virus protein, stopping its ability to replicate. Because it is excreted through the urine, the risk of interacting with other drugs is low. But the price tag? Well, that's high. As we mentioned, $84,000 to treat one person for 12 weeks. The current regimen combines Sovaldi with interferon, still a problem for a lot of people. Depending on your point of view, the situation is about to get a lot better for patients with hepatitis C and a lot more expensive for the healthcare system. Again, Dr. Paul Kuo.
This coming winter, within October, November, December, sofosbuvir will be approved with another direct-acting antiviral agent without interferon. And at least in the registration trials for people who've never been treated, the cure rates were essentially 99%. Which is very, wow is correct. Wow.
The new regimen will also be much simpler. No more injections.
One pill or two or three pills a day. That's it. And I mean minimal side effects.
And what would be the minimal side
effects? Okay. A little bit of fatigue, pruritus, a little bit of itching. Nothing like we have now.
People who are cured of hepatitis C are less likely to need a transplant, but still need to be monitored as they recover from the liver damage. But here's something the liver can do that other organs cannot. It can heal itself.
For instance, if you have a heart attack, unless you get the blood supply fixed to the heart very quickly, you're at risk for significant damage to the heart. With the liver, actually, you can have this virus for years, get moderate or severe scarring. If you're cured, and we have seen this here, and it's been demonstrated in many trials, that this fibrosis for hepatitis C and many other diseases gets better and actually goes away.
So with the virus gone and healing possible, people who had hepatitis C are now less likely to need expensive liver transplants. Now that saves money and frees up donated livers for other patients.
And so it really holds hope for people, which is why efforts are being made to find and screen the people with hepatitis C, because if we find them, diagnose them, and link them to care, then we'll have the opportunity to prevent these end-stage complications, which are not only more difficult to treat, but clearly lead to greater costs to the entire healthcare system.
But what about the price? Claire Cruising is Director of Communications of America's Health Insurance Plans. That group is concerned not just about the cost per person of Sovaldi and other drugs in the same class. AHIP is also raising alarms about the total cost to the healthcare system as more people become eligible to take it.
Research shows that the high price of these drugs are driving up premiums, are increasing cost sharing for consumers. So I think that's the important consideration to keep in mind, is that drug makers are essentially asking for a blank check because they know insurance companies, they know the government will pay for this. But really, patients too are forced to, you know, carry that price tag and face that extra cost in their premiums or in their cost sharing. The question is naturally, are we pricing those drugs at a way that patients can access them? And really, these high price tags are a barrier for patients that are seeking these treatments.
Congress has been asking questions about why the price of Sovaldi is so high, but so far, nobody has put forward a solution to this puzzle.
We want to avoid government price controls and are focusing on bringing together stakeholders across the industry to find a sustainable solution so the government doesn't have to. So it's really bringing everyone to the table to find a solution that works for drug makers and works for patients and works for broader health systems so that access to these treatments can be sustained.
Dr. Paul Kuo, professor at the IU School of Medicine.
The jury is still out on this, but I actually think there are some of these individuals, I don't know if we're going to completely reverse everything, but you can already see early signals that you can make things better by treating this disease.
It sounds like a sea change here. I mean, this is revolutionizing.
It is hard to think of another disease that has evolved in therapeutic efficacy at this rapid a rate. We all knew this was going to happen. Many of us thought it would be 5 or 10 years later, and just, I think, all credit to an enormous community of liver doctors out there that dedicated themselves to the last 10 years, and there are many all over the U.S. and the world that have dedicated themselves to trying to get rid of this virus. And I think you're going to see that for many people whose lives have been substantially affected by this disease, that they are going to be able to be offered what I consider an enormous opportunity to get rid of the virus. I think you're going to change the face of what we see with liver cancer, because I think the cases gradually will go down. Transplantation is going to change because we're going to be curing the hepatitis C. There are many other liver diseases that require transplant, and it will be an opportunity for people with other diseases to have an opportunity to have those organs without the intense competition we have now. So I think overall, from a global health perspective, this is going to really help the healthcare community that we all practice in.
This is a debate that's going to continue for a while. We'll follow it and keep you posted.
I'm Eric Metcalf, and your Sound Medicine stat for the day is 10. You might stay healthier while looking cool in a 2009-era way by doing fist bumps. In a new study, one researcher repeatedly dipped a gloved hand into E. coli, then gave different greetings to a fellow gloved researcher: a handshake, a high five, and a fist bump. The handshake transferred nearly twice as many bacteria as the high five, but it spread more than 10 times more bacteria than the fist bump. The authors, who were British and may or may not have been doing the fist bump like we do in the colonies, encourage adoption of this greeting as a more hygienic alternative to the handshake. Given that the origins of the handshake may have been to demonstrate that you're a friendly person who isn't holding a weapon, here's another alternative. Simply wave while announcing, "I have no weapon, but I might have E. coli on my hands." That was the number 10, and I'm Eric Metcalf.
Coming up, another use for low-dose aspirin that might help pregnant women avoid a serious complication.
Preeclampsia is just kind of the beginning features of a situation that can become much worse.
And later, a doctor who has turned her avocation into her vocation, one triathlon at a time.
So many of them were overweight, sedentary, depressed, had diabetes, all these things that I felt like, you know, these folks really need a lifestyle change. And I felt very passionate about the way I was living my own life and wanted to share that.
You're listening to Sound Medicine. Welcome back to Sound Medicine. I'm Barbara Lewis. Jill Dittmeyer is here now with this week's health news headlines.
Thanks, Barb. As the number of cases of Ebola continues to rise in West Africa, a Canadian company says it plans to start human safety trials of an Ebola vaccine later this summer. NewLink Genetics Corporation has licensed the vaccine developed by scientists with the Public Health Agency of Canada. It is ramping up manufacturing now with plans to produce several thousand doses of the vaccine in the next month or so. Here's a pretty stunning prediction. The CDC is predicting that approximately 2 of every 5 Americans will develop type 2 diabetes at some point in their adult lives. And among certain minority groups, it's even scarier. Half of Black women and Hispanic men and women are predicted to develop the chronic condition. The drugs commonly prescribed to treat osteoporosis, known as bisphosphonates, do not seem to lower the risk of breast cancer, as previously thought. Researchers at UC San Francisco took another look at 2 clinical trials of drugs in that class. They concluded that it wasn't that they helped reduce breast cancer after all. Instead, the study published in JAMA Internal Medicine speculates that the same low estrogen levels that can lead to bone density problems also make it less likely that breast tumors will grow.
This is easy. So here we go.
And finally,
3, 2, 1, woo!
This was the week when ice buckets went viral, or more specifically, when a fundraising project called the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge caught on like crazy, involving everyone from sports stars to Ethel Kennedy. The gimmick was that each person poured a bucket of ice water over his or her head and challenged others to do the same thing, or to make a donation to fight ALS, the neurological condition also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. The association was positively giddy with the results. More than $4 million in donations in less than 2 weeks, quadruple the same period last year. Reporting for Sound Medicine, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
Health news headlines are presented in part by the Marion University College of Osteopathic Medicine in Indianapolis.
You've heard for years about the advantages of taking low-dose aspirin to head off heart problems. A new review of earlier studies has found that the same strategy could help pregnant women avoid the condition known as preeclampsia, which can lead to preterm birth and other serious consequences. We turn to our healthy living expert, Dr. Teresa Rohr-Kirschgraber, for a little perspective, starting with a reminder of what preeclampsia is.
Preeclampsia is a condition in which a pregnant woman develops high blood pressure, and usually that's blood pressure of greater than 140 over 90, protein in their urine, which is known as proteinuria. And usually this is observed somewhere during the second half of pregnancy, usually after about 20 weeks of being pregnant. These two first features are kind of considered as preeclampsia, which are kind of the warning signs. The problem is that preeclampsia can then be associated and gone on to even further complications, including markedly high blood pressures of greater than 160 over 110, eventually causing low platelet counts, which can cause problems with bleeding, liver troubles, kidney troubles, eventually even leading to seizures and fluid in the lungs. So preeclampsia is just kind of the beginning features of a situation that can become much worse.
Now, the review found that aspirin could lower the risk of preeclampsia and some other pregnancy-related problems. What exactly were the benefits and risks, and how significant were they?
Well, before we encourage pregnant women to take aspirin just on their own, let me kind of clarify that this really is trying to determine those women that are at high risk for developing preeclampsia and its consequences. How can we prevent it in that specific group? Because aspirin is a great medication. It's been around for a long time, but it needs to be used with caution. And so this study was really looking at a number of actually pulled together information from a number of other studies to try to help answer that question again. How do we identify those women that are at the biggest risk for developing this condition? And if so, then how can we prevent it and how aspirin can be used for that?
So who would benefit? Who is at the highest risk that might benefit from low-dose aspirin?
Well, we know that almost 4% of deliveries in the United States, there have been some association with preeclampsia. And so that's actually a fair number. The women that are at higher risk are those women who already have a diagnosis of high blood pressure. They have diabetes. They have renal disease. They have other autoimmune diseases such as lupus or a condition associated with lupus called the antiphospholipid syndrome. They're older mothers to start out with, or they have already had a pregnancy that had preeclampsia associated with it. In that specific group, those women are at highest risk for developing preeclampsia and then eventually the consequences of.
Are these women usually taking aspirin already for as part of their regimen for any of these conditions?
Not usually. Although aspirin can be used for certain types of medical problems. For example, if you've already had a heart attack, aspirin is useful to help decrease the clotting and help the blood to flow around the heart a little bit better. If you are a diabetic, there's potential you could be on aspirin for exactly that same reason. There may be some other very specific situations in which aspirin is actually used as a treatment for a condition, but it's not a common medication to be used, especially in young pregnant women.
So how do doctors currently try to prevent and manage preeclampsia?
Well, one is by having good prenatal care. We really want to have the women coming in as early as possible. And in fact, there is a push to do some what we call preconception counseling so that even before you decide to become pregnant, that we look at you as a whole person and try to determine what are those things that are risk factors that you can help to work on even before you become pregnant, so that from the very second that you get pregnant, you have the best possible chance for that child to be born healthy and happy.
So your takeaway from this study?
The takeaway from this study is that there's still a lot of work to be done. I think there's a lot of enthusiasm for working more to find ways to help prevent preeclampsia. The main takeaway, though, is get in to see your physician early in the pregnancy. Be very conscientious about decreasing your risk factors for developing preeclampsia. Work on those things that you can do. And be very proactive and speaking with your doctor about what the risks are. And if your physician recommends the use of aspirin, then do so with their recommendation. And to be very conscientious about following all the recommendations.
Dr. Teresa Rohr-Kirschgraber, thank you so much.
Thank you, Barb.
Dr. Teresa Rohr-Kirschgraber is Chief Physician Executive for the Outpatient Care Center at Eskenazi Health and a regular contributor here on Sound Medicine. So, whether it's baby aspirin or a complicated regimen of pills that need to be taken at precise times of day, one obstacle that doctors encounter is patients who just won't do it, won't take their medicine, even after the risks of not doing so have been laid out before them. Dr. Albert Fuchs is in primary care in Beverly Hills, California. He recently wrote an essay online about how doctors can and should deal with that situation. He spoke with Sound Medicine's Jill Dittmeyer.
Dr. Albert Fuchs, welcome to Sound Medicine.
Thank you very much.
In general, Americans are a very heavily medicated people. But oftentimes, doctors will have patients that say they really don't want to take medicine for their symptoms. Do you have those types of conversations with your patients?
I sure do. And it might be because I'm in Los Angeles, where people are very health conscious but very medication wary. But I have a lot of patients who, really without thinking about it, just are quite averse to taking medications.
And I would think there's a big difference between someone who says, I don't want to take that, and that says, I won't take that medication. If the patient truly won't take the medication that you're prescribing, what do you do?
I mean, I always try to do my best to educate the patient about why it is that I'm recommending it and try to elicit the patient's concerns, because I won't is sometimes just shorthand for I have very reasonable concerns about cost or about side effects or about other things. But ultimately, an educated patient is free to refuse any kind of care. And once I've done my job of education, the patient is the boss and he or she can make her own decision.
And how do you kind of convince someone if they're still kind of hedging as you're having this conversation with them? How long of a conversation will you have with them before you just give up?
That's a great question, and I'm lucky because I have an unusual, purposefully tiny practice where I can spend a lot of time. I think the problem is bigger in regular practices because physicians really are pressed for time and have to get to the next patient, and they may use the excuse of the patient's refusal to leave the education at that and document the refusal and get to the next patient. You know, it's always a judgment call how long and how hard to push without straining the relationship. I usually make a couple of good faith efforts to at least explain why I think the medication would be helpful and try to find out from the patient why the patient is hesitant. But ultimately, I don't want to alienate the patient. I don't want to get the patient angry. So after a couple of attempts, I leave it at that.
As a patient, what can we do when we go into our doctor and he says, I want you to take this medication, we really don't want to take it? What questions can we ask the doctor to get on a better sense of understanding with him or her?
Well, so I guess my first advice would start before the visit, which is to just go into it with an open mind, meaning the whole goal of the post on my website that you guys are interviewing me about was to have people challenge their preconceptions and realize that their goal isn't to be on as few medications as possible. Their goal is really to benefit from all the medications that have a bigger benefit than harm to them. So not stating something that's just a bias, something that the patient may have never heard of or thought about before, and is something that they've just heard everybody else say, so they've just picked it up as a preconception, like, I don't want to take any medicines, or I want to take as few medicines as possible. If you spend 10 seconds to think about that and realize that's not really true, and instead find out what your concern really is and ask that to the doctor, like, is this medicine expensive, or what side effects might I expect from this medicine, or, is this medicine going to interact with other medicines, or I've heard that this causes sexual side effects? Should I be worried about that? Tell the doctor what you're really worried about, and then you can have a conversation that educates you about the medicine, and then you can make an informed decision.
We're speaking with Dr. Albert Fuchs. He's a general internist in private practice in Beverly Hills, California. Now, are there certain drugs, though, that should kind of raise a red flag if our doctor says, I think you should take these?
Not in general. There's no medications that are, you know, that are never a good idea. But, of course, habit-forming medicines should always give people pause. Unfortunately, they generally don't. Patients occasionally seek these medications out, of course. But there's no family of medicines that I would say, you know, be careful if your doctor ever prescribes these. I would say rather always find out for whatever you're going to take what the possible harms are and what the benefits to you are.
And what's your experience with other doctors? Do they run into this problem a lot?
Yes, and again, I don't know if that's geographic because we're here in Los Angeles or if that's just a common problem everywhere, but yeah, I talk to doctors all the time that have patients with very serious chronic conditions who would do much better on some very safe medications but think that they either can do fine without them or they're afraid of trying it or have some other bias against medications that we don't understand.
And what do those doctors do? I'm hoping they have some other options for the patient because I wouldn't think a doctor would want their patient to go untreated when they know they need some kind of help.
We can always try other approaches for diabetes. Eating a very low carbohydrate diet helps, but only helps a little. And if people need medication, diet is not going to be, even a perfect diet is not going to be a good substitute for medications.
Well, Dr. Albert Fuchs, thank you so much for joining us.
It was fun. Thank you.
Dr. Albert Fuchs is a general internist in private practice in Beverly Hills, California. We'll post further discussions of anti-medication bias at our website. You'll find those by going to soundmedicine.org. And if you have a story about why you don't follow doctor's orders, maybe you'd like to share it with the class at our Facebook page. We've talked about hospice care on this program many times over the past few years, but it's always pretty much gone without saying that we've been talking about hospice care for people. But there is hospice care for pets, specially designed care for animals that are near the end of their lives to keep them comfortable and to keep them pain-free. We asked Sound Medicine's healthy pets expert, Dr. Liz Murphy, about this trend.
Hospice care in pets is actually a new organized concept, but it's probably something that a lot of veterinarians and their pet owners have done for a long time. Unfortunately, our dogs and cats and other pets just don't live quite as long as we do. And so many owners are faced at some point with the prospect of their dog or cat having a terminal illness or a debilitating disease, or even in the case of just older dogs and cats having debilitating arthritis. So most veterinarians work with the pet owner for various ways to make that pet as comfortable as possible.
Is that pain relief really are what we're talking about?
Yes, yes, we are. That plus nutrition and keeping the pet comfortable as long as that pet is around until a decision is either made to euthanize that pet or allow the pet to die naturally. Many veterinarians will work with pet owners for some home care options for their pets that are terminally ill. But there are some people that have felt that they've been pressured to either to euthanize or to just take them home and let nature take its course without any support. And I think that the hospice movement for people has helped crystallize an instinct that many veterinarians have had for many years, is to, once the decision is made, to not diagnose or treat a particular illness. We want to allow that pet to have comfort and dignity and have that owner have the opportunity to say goodbye, but without the pressure of having to make a decision at that time. Many people become stressed as their pets become stressed coming into the clinic for pain medications, fluids that we give subcutaneously or under the surface of the skin to dogs or cats that are dehydrated. And owners sometimes want the option of just allowing their pet to be at home. And many veterinarians would like to have the ability to make that pet comfortable at home, but continue communication with the pet owner to make sure that pet is pain-free, has good nutrition, isn't developing bed sores or some sort of skin infection from being overly wet, and make sure the hygiene is good.
So this is something that's done at home?
Yes.
Okay.
There are actually more hospice organizations and many veterinary clinics that in a formal way provide hospice care to pets in the home because it is stressful for pets to be away. There are a couple of hospice organizations in the country that kind of have a daycare facility for terminally ill pets so that people go to work and they know that their pets are being cared for. They're receiving their medications, they're being allowed to be themselves, but they've got somebody to watch them.
What has the reaction been from pet owners when you bring this up as an option?
People are surprised that this option can exist, and I think they're extremely grateful. In general, what formal hospice care does is usually provide a consultation either with a person's veterinarian or a hospice veterinarian that isn't part of that person's normal veterinary practice. They have a consultation, usually in the home, about the plans for this particular pet, what types of things that that owner would like to do, how to recognize when it's time to make a decision or to allow things to happen naturally. And so the big thing about hospice is it's been formalized, that people talk to the owners and they create a plan. And then either ongoing care is done in the home with medications, as I mentioned, fluids, making sure that the pet is given enough nutrition and cared for well. And oftentimes after that ongoing care is over with, a decision is made for end-of-life care, either euthanasia in the home, allowing the animal to pass on his or her own, and then a plan is also made with the owner for what they would like to do afterwards. And for, as I say, for many people, this is something that they just never really knew was a formal option. They just felt alone sometimes, and it's now very, very nice to know that there are many organizations and many veterinarians that are open to not just the cure, but for preparation for the end of life.
Dr. Liz Murphy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Elizabeth Murphy is a veterinarian in Indianapolis, and she's a regular guest here on Sound Medicine. If you had the chance to sit quietly in a room, no phone, no music, nothing to distract you from your own thoughts, would you take it? Folks in one study we read recently had a very clear answer. Please, no. Jill Dittmeyer explains in this week's Sound Medicine Checkup.
Just how hard could it be for a college student to spend some time using only their mind to entertain themselves? Harder than psychology professor Tim Wilson and his colleagues at the University of Virginia imagined.
So we took away their cell phones and writing implements and purses and everything. And then we asked them to sit in a room that was unadorned. There was nothing on the walls. And we gave them some really simple instructions. We just said, could you sit here for a few minutes?
But they couldn't.
I wouldn't say they were miserable, but most people were kind of bored and didn't seem to take advantage of the time in some sense.
Wilson thought the setting might have been a distraction, so he let the students try the experiment at home. But that didn't work either.
In fact, many people told us that they couldn't get through our so-called thinking period without cheating by reaching for their phone or turning on music.
Researchers were perplexed.
It didn't seem like it should be that hard to us. I mean, after all, each of us has a big brain that's stocked full of pleasant memories that we could call on, or things we're looking forward to in the future, or the ability just to let our minds wander to pleasant topics.
As last-ditch effort, they offered the students a choice: sit and think quietly or take an electrical shock.
kind of like a severe static shock. This isn't, you know, really strong, but a little painful. So everyone did it and said, yeah, that was a little painful. I don't really want to do that again.
But they could.
So they had electrodes attached to their ankles, and we said, the button's there, and it's really up to you. We'd prefer you entertain yourself with your thoughts, but if for any reason you want to press the button, you can.
So they did.
Two-thirds of men took at least one shock, and about a quarter of women did so.
And what do you make of that?
Well, it seems that many people want to shock themselves out of boredom, is one way of putting it.
And while daunted, Wilson is not discouraged.
So I think we would all benefit if stressful times of our day, we could just retreat into our minds for a few minutes and kind of chill out.
Shock treatment, I'm doing fine. Give me shock treatment. Give me shock treatment.
Reporting for Sound Medicine, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
I want a shock treatment.
Do you want to listen to Sound Medicine anytime? Sign up for our free weekly podcast. Click the box at our website, soundmedicine.org. You can also find us at iTunes, at Stitcher Radio, and at Swell AM.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Welcome back to Sound Medicine. I'm Barbara Lewis. Going to medical school, as you probably know, is a grind. It's hard to find time to sleep and to eat, much less get good exercise. But my next guest found the time and then some. We'll let her explain what happened next. Dr. Susanna Carter, welcome to Sound Medicine. It is good to talk with you.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be invited to talk.
Well, you ran your first Ironman triathlon during your medical residency?
I sure did.
Because you weren't busy enough?
Exactly. I had some extra time on my hands. No, I sure did. I was getting into something I didn't know, which is probably ignorance is bliss, right? It was probably best.
Right. Well, let's inform our listeners here about those who aren't familiar with the Ironman. Can you tell us exactly what that race requires you to do?
Yes, it is a long-distance triathlon that is composed of a 2.4-mile open water swim, 112-mile bicycle ride, and then a full marathon, 26.2-mile run, all in succession.
Oh my gosh. So have you been an athlete all your life?
I really have in some form or another. I started off very young swimming and then went through the whole team sport phase, soccer, basketball, and really began doing individual things like running and cycling later in college.
Okay, so a lot of us say we don't have time to work out, but here you are as doing your residency and you are able to train for this. What was that like? I mean, how did you fit in the training for it?
It was intense, as it is in any stage in life training for one of those. But I don't know. I think I was a little bit the black sheep or the odd man out in residency. I sort of had this die-hard need to take care of myself, and taking care of myself for me was exercise. And I just found a lot of joy in being out on the bike after being cooped up in the hospital for long hours. And I had always loved swimming. You know, it was just sort of a natural thing for me to do to take care of myself. And, residents as a whole, you're sort of in survival mode. So a lot of us don't take care of ourselves during that time. And I don't know if I was born with it or what, but I was pretty bent on getting my exercise and just knew the right people to get me into triathlon.
Mm-hmm. Well, the first time you attended an Ironman competition, you were a spectator, and the enthusiasm you saw at the starting line really stuck with you. Can you describe the sorts of people you find at these events?
Absolutely. It was a life-changing moment. The end of these, you have 17 hours to complete it. So the finish line by the end of that 17 hours, it's at midnight, and it's packed with people, fans, people who finished, family, and the announcer's got a lot of energy, and he's calling everybody across the line. And I just sat back and watched people come through, and these, of course, were the people that have been out there the longest. And I saw 70-year-olds, 80-year-olds, people with prosthetic limbs, young people, just people sort of defying those messages in our culture of too young or too ill or too this or that to get out and really do something amazing.
Yeah. Well, what prompted you to leave the medical profession fairly early in your career? You were an OBGYN and you became a health and wellness coach.
I did. And I think there's just a theme that runs through it. I realized that in my practice, I just sort of was feeling off purpose. I think all along I was sort of fighting this need to take care of myself and really live a healthy lifestyle, and I found that to challenge with the hours and the stress of medicine. But I also found that my patients, whom I love dearly, even though I was there doing pap smears and mammograms and useful things that we need, I was feeling off purpose because so many of them were overweight, sedentary, depressed, had diabetes, all these things that I felt like, these folks really need a lifestyle change. And I felt very passionate about the way I was living my own life and wanted to share that.
Mm-hmm. So you started a website called Project 150. What does that number have to do with exercise?
Yes. I read the text put out by the American College of Sports Medicine called Exercise is Medicine, and a whole sort of world opened to me. It's a text that sort of calls upon physicians to really take the prescription of exercise for patients seriously, that instead of giving out pills, we also need to be encouraging them to exercise to prevent disease and also to fight disease. And 150 minutes is currently what they recommend that each of us get weekly in exercise. And almost nobody does this.
Right, but you do. So at what point do you already hit the 150-minute mark?
Woo, sometimes by Monday afternoon. I would say, some of my workouts are 2.5 hours, so I could get that on any given day. But most of the time, Tuesday or Wednesday, I've already gotten in my 150 minutes.
Okay, so for the rest of us, though, finding 2.5 hours of physical activity can be difficult, it can be time-consuming, it can be challenging, I guess name your synonym for unpleasant, for the
sure.
rest of us. How can people shift their attitudes toward exercise so it becomes more enjoyable and something we may one day achieve by Monday afternoon?
Well, it's a great question, and what I've found is that there isn't time in practice as a physician just sitting there trying to do all the things that I'm supposed to do to really talk to people. And because it's a psychological shift, it's a shift in thinking of how do I want to live my life, what do I want for my health, and how intentional am I going to be about getting that. And that takes time to talk to people about and really pull it out of them. Do you value this? Do you see it worth changing some things in your life to really optimize your health? Spending time with people, having meaningful conversations, letting them really talk and tell me what it is they want, and then we collaborate and find a way to fit it into their lives, it becomes something they're really engaged in. And I think that's the key, is getting people fully engaged in their health. They got to take that step towards me, and I'm going to take a step towards them, and we're going to do it together.
Mm-hmm. Now, it seems like if people have come to you, they're really trying to make that change. So you already have somebody that's motivated?
Yeah, to some degree. They may be a little scared. They may have a lot of fear about their abilities to do it. They may have all of those things that you mentioned, sort of the schedule that is unrelenting, and kids and no time. But there's something in them that brought them to me to begin with. So that's what we really focus on. And, they've gotten to the point where they feel like they have to do something. And they value their health enough. So there is that piece that they have to bring.
For people wanting to lose weight or maintain their weight, even 150 minutes a week may not be enough. I know the American College of Sports Medicine is recommending 250 minutes or more. How realistic or, how can busy mm-hmm. people fit that into their weekly schedule?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And, 150 minutes is the absolute minimum sort of for health, to get your heart functioning well and your blood pumping. So it's true. It's this minimum amount that we need. And beyond that is really where weight loss and, coming off of medications occurs. It's tough, but I'll tell you, when I see the statistics on how much television people watch, it's something like the average kid is watching 1,500 minutes of TV in a week. So 150 or 250 really pales in comparison. And I find, talking to people, we can carve out some time. If you can carve out time for checking out, numbing out watching TV, we can find you 30 to 45 minutes where you can exercise. It's not going to magically happen. I think when people try to keep their priority list the same and lose weight, that's why they fail. They got to reset that priority list a little bit, and they got to put their health at the top now instead of, perhaps not even on the list.
So for people who don't maybe want to go to the extreme of a triathlon, a 17-hour mm-hmm. Ironman, what are some of the smaller challenges that they can create? I mean, when you're working with somebody and you're first trying to figure out what it is that motivates them, what do you recommend?
And that's also great because I surely don't think everybody should be out there doing Ironman. it's kind of funny. I just want people to do the minimum to start there. I try to work on building confidence over time with small successes. And it's the same way that I train. I didn't start out being a triathlete and bam, I was great at it. I had to start small and build the time I spent on it and build the intensity into my workouts. And so for people starting out, perhaps they've been sedentary their whole lives, we start with really simple goals of this week, I want you to just get outside and move your body for 5 to 10 minutes every morning and tell me what that feels like. You know, be fully present while you're doing it. Check in with your muscles. You know, let's work on it becoming a habit for you before we worry about how long you're doing it or how intense you're doing it. Mm-hmm. And people get confidence. They think, wow, I can do this. You know, I may have only done 35 minutes this week, but that's 35 more minutes than I've exercised in the past 3 months.
For your clients, on average, are they people who are already pretty motivated and want to get more, or are they people like that example that you just gave?
I have a variety, I would say. I have some people who have already taken some initiatives, and maybe they're meeting a trainer already a couple times a week. But I have one person in mind that, you know, hadn't exercised literally in about 5-6 years. Another one actually said it had been since his college days, and he's in his late 50s. So I have, you know, I have a variety. I have some who are already a little bit active and others who really just haven't been, but they are motivated for change.
Can you tell who's going to succeed and who might not?
Well, I'm learning, certainly learning all the time. I find that people who... I don't know. I guess I call them all in, who are all in. They're fully engaged in the project, and that's what I try to talk to them about in the beginning. It's we're not going to just try to slap on this little exercise, weight loss, nutrition goal on the side of your already busy life. We're going to start working on changing your life to really prioritize these things, kind of fully engage in this. Those people that meet with me weekly bring a food log weekly. They sit down. They want to go over it. They email me when they have a setback because they want motivation. When they're all in like that and fully engaged, they do amazing.
Dr. Susanna Carter, thank you so much for talking with me. It's really been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. I'm honored to be asked. I appreciate it.
Dr. Susanna Carter is a health and wellness coach in Birmingham, Alabama. We'll post a link to her, project150.com, on our website. Just go to soundmedicine.org. And finally, getting out on your bike is a great way to rack up some of those 150 minutes of exercise every week.
Help yourself.
In this installment of Help Yourself, Sound Medicine contributor Sandy Robe has a few safety tips so you can get home in one piece.
Summer means it's time to get outside and go places. For those not quite old enough to drive, nothing brings more freedom than hopping on a bicycle. Whether your children are biking to a friend's house, sports practice, school, or for exercise, there's something you won't want them to forget. A helmet.
The two things that are probably the most important in terms of keeping kids safe on bikes is wearing a helmet and staying alert. So it's important not just that they protect their brains while on their bikes, but also that they're aware of what's going on around them so they can avoid hazards like cars and other bikers that are around them.
Dr. Elizabeth Weinstein, director of Indianapolis Emergency Medical Services for Children, says head injuries are the most common reason people die from bike accidents. 90% of bike-related deaths occur in people who are not wearing a helmet. Reducing those statistics should be easy. Safety experts estimate that using a properly fitted helmet can reduce the risk of head injury
by up to 88%. So that's a really big number. And in fact, it's estimated that universal bike helmet use by kids ages 4 to 15 would prevent as many as 45,000 head injuries and up to 55,000 scalp and face injuries every year.
That's why Charlie Rivard, owner of the bike line in Broad Ripple, tries to sell a helmet with each new bike. He also suggests that customers replace old helmets every few years to meet the latest safety standards. As for finding the best fit, he starts by grabbing a couple off the shelf for customers to try on.
We figure out what shape fits your head, set the straps up. A lot of new modern helmets that we sell have the Loctite or zip tights on the back, so they dial in and fit very easily to the head.
Rivard says if you can't get a snug fit, consider going down a helmet size. Or if you can't get it all the way down on your head, bump up a size. Once you have the proper helmet fit, you'll want to make sure you also wear brightly colored clothes so you can be seen on the road or trail. As for what not to wear while biking, there's no need to accessorize with earphones. As much as we love music, it's best to leave the tunes at home so we have one less problem or distraction.
Unfortunately, when you're biking, that soundtrack, especially if it's in your ears, can really prevent you from being aware of oncoming traffic or bikes that are nearby or someone sort of giving you that verbal warning, hey, watch out, if you have time to react.
All in all, if you want to increase the likelihood that your children will wear a helmet, you'll want to wear one as well. Adults who model good behavior for kids generally get good results. I'm Sandy Robe, encouraging you to help yourself.
And that's it for this week's program. We're always interested in what you'd like to hear about on Sound Medicine. You can post comments about today's program on Facebook and submit questions that we might answer on future shows. And we're always on at soundmedicine.org. Sound Medicine's senior producer is Nora Hyatt. Eric Metcalf prepares our interviews. Chris Lieber records and edits the program, and he chooses our music. Jen Burnham manages our website as well as all things social media. Steve Ali of Jazzville Studios wrote our theme music, and the executive producer is Eric Eggleton. Sound Medicine is a copyrighted 2014 production of the Indiana University Trustees and WFYI, Metropolitan Indianapolis Public Broadcasting Incorporated, all rights reserved. I'm Barbara Lewis, wishing you good health.
Sound Medicine is produced by WFYI in association with Indiana University and the IU School of Medicine and is presented in part by IUPUI, what matters where it matters.
Thanks for listening. For more information about anything you heard on this podcast, please go to our website, soundmedicine.org. I'm Barbara Lewis, wishing you good health.